This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
What you will hear in this program is definitely not the climate message that most people are getting, including climate activists. We might have to prepare for a planet which is cooling in some unexpected places, where more than a billion people live, and that's during powerful global warming. The future is just more complex. We're entering a climate zone far outside the popular worldview, and it bites you back when you do understand it. It's not great news. So the future, the real future, will be bumpy with destroyer storms, with record heat waves, yes, but possibly punctuated by cold waves and, for many of you, colder oceans. Dr. Andrew Y. Glickson is an Australian scientist with an expertise in geology, in asteroid hits and volcanoes, in past extinction events, and in climate change. We last spoke with Andrew for an hour in December 2017, and we were discussing, can humans survive? Andrew and I have remained in email conversation for years. This August, the journal Climatic Change published his paper, North Atlantic and Sub-Antarctic Ocean Temperatures, Possible Onset of a Transient Stadial Cooling Stage. Now, I resisted this, and partly because the cooling event has been so abused by climate deniers, and they seek any excuse to keep on burning fossil fuels and consuming the earth, and so I didn't want to help that along. But Andrew Glickson's paper builds on research published in 2016 by James Hansen and follows a long lineage of senior scientists going right back to the late American Dean of Climate Science, Wallace or Wally Broecker, who popularized the term global warming in 1975. So we have to face it. The development of climate change will not be the steady ramp of hotter every decade, as shown on most charts from the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change or published in newspapers and blogs. Get ready for something completely different. Andrew Glickson, it's great to welcome you back to Radio EcoShock.
Yeah, thank you very much, Alex.
Andrew, you could be retired, sipping drinks on your back deck in Australia. Why do you keep banging away at climate science?
The simple answer is because I cannot not do that. The issue is too huge, bigger than all of us. And I have now studied the Earth and the climate for, well, almost longer than 50 years. And what we're looking at is something that you either blink or you continue to look at into. It's as basic as that. But I have to add to your introduction that, unfortunately, what we're looking at is not good news. It follows in a way, in fact, in a major way, James Hansen projections, which are, in a way, summarized in his book, Storms of My Grandchildren. And the storms would be caused, and already have started, commenced, due to a clash between warming continents, on the one hand, and the flow of ice melt water into the oceans, on the other hand. We already have large regions of cold ice melt water to the south of Greenland, and we already have such cold pools along the Antarctic coastline. Now, I am not at all clear why the IPCC has overlooked, or as far as I'm aware, overlooked the effects of the flow of ice melt water into the oceans. Because when Greenland melts, and certainly when the huge Antarctic ice sheet melts, the cold water goes into the oceans. It must have an effect. It cannot not have an effect, and it already has an effect. And yet it has been either overlooked or ignored for totally inexplicable reasons. But unfortunately, this does not mean global cooling. Unfortunately, what it means is a clash between warm fronts, such as the form over the continents, the forming now, and the effects of the ice melt water on the oceans. The boundaries between them will be, and already started to be, extremely stormy. You have to look first at the Caribbeans, at the Southwest Pacific Islands, to appreciate the magnitude and frequency of these hurricanes and cyclones.
Yeah, look, there was just a huge typhoon hit Japan, over 70 dead that I know of, and they're still counting. And all of the structures that Japan has built, they've been building for water control. Almost every river and stream is encased in concrete. They've spent billions on trying to protect themselves from these kinds of storms. And now they're saying, well, it's just not enough. It's in the New York Times. It's not going to work. They can't defend themselves against the storms. And I think this is what has happened with Hurricane Sandy and with Hurricane Dorian that just swept over the Bahamas. It could be that these storms will define history.
Well, yes. Russell denies the science. They're going to jump on it, as usual, and misrepresent and falsify and lie. They're going to do it. But science cannot overlook major observations. It's just inherent in science. It would have been wonderful if it was good news. It would be delightful. But such storminess cannot be good news. The continents continue to warm, and the oceans already started in some parts to cool along the fringe of the ice melt. I don't know how to go around what you have pointed out can be the risk in that the deniers will use it for their own ends. But I rather not deny what I think the science is indicating. And it's not my original view. It's James Hansen's indications. When you look at his maps, charts, which I've sent you, and also other authors now are looking at it, you will see what's happening. Large parts of the oceans are cooling, but large parts of the continents continue to warm due to the greenhouse effect. And that map, the charts which I sent you, does not show the storms, but inevitably when you get such large masses of warm air fronts and cold air fronts, the earth becomes so stormy, or much of large parts of the earth, especially the coastal regions, become stormy to the effect that it prevents the agriculture and in some cases even human habitat.
So you're talking about a paper that James Hansen and about 18 other co-authors published in 2015, and then that paper was revised in 2016. It's huge, and it's got a huge title. I'm just going to read out the title for listeners who are interested. It's called Ice Melt, Sea Level Rise, and Superstorms: Evidence from Paleoclimate Data, Climate Modeling, and Modern Observations that 2 degrees C global warming could be dangerous. And that's the title. So in those charts, what does Hansen show happening? Let's talk about south of Greenland, the big blob of cold water there. What does he show happening as this century unfolds?
To simplify things, there are two charts which indicate what he's talking about. One shows the progression of temperature between now and the 23rd century, and it shows major kinks, major cooling episodes. Each of them lasts a few decades and so on. And this depends on the rate of ice melt. We call them stadial. Stadial is a cooling event, a cooling episode following a warming episode. And the other one shows actually the temperature map of the Earth by the end of the century and also later on. I think 2096 or so, but the precise date does not matter. And this shows this extensive ocean cooling and the continuing warming of the continent. Now, I want to add a comment regarding the IPCC. The IPCC reports are based on the very best peer-reviewed science. There's no doubt about it. But there is a saying which says, no committee has ever written a symphony. And I'm sure you know what I mean. When it comes to synthesizing all these papers and reports together, something might have been missed, but it's a big thing which might have been missed. They show warming trends, virtually smooth ones, which are very, very rare in the history of the climate. You almost never see anything like that. The warming would progress, like, say, up to 2, 3, 4 degrees and higher in a smooth line or curve. It's completely contradictory to anything we're looking at. It's the evolution of the climate and temperatures. But that's what they show, graph and plot after plot. This immediately seems to me to be less than realistic. It's only a projection then. then there are virtually no kinks up or down in this graph. And this causes suspicion because most of what I study is the history of the climate. I started to look at the projections, and sure enough, James Sampson has looked at it well before me. And so I largely follow his science, which is absolutely pioneering and, in my view, some of the best science, climate science that I've ever come across or read. So I'd say something happened here to the effect of no committee has ever written a symphony and something has been missed. It's not the only problem with IPCC projection. There are other ones, underestimate of ice melt rates and underestimate of fires and so on. But these are minor compared to what we're looking at in the projections.
So I looked up stadial events in Wikipedia, and they talked about the most recent one, I think, which happened not too long before our current period and our invention of agriculture. Could you talk to us about the younger Dryas stadial event?
Yes, sure. There is even a younger one at 8,300. It's a Laurentian melt, not very far from where you are, or closer to you than it is to me. Anyway, that's when the Laurentian ice sheets has melted a large extent and eventually disappeared. And the ice melt water flew into what was called Lake Agassiz. It does not exist now, but there was a lake like that in the central north U.S. and Canada. And from the lake, this enormous lake, the water flew into the Atlantic Ocean. This was a stadial event, and there are a number of important papers about it in quite a deal of detail. It lasted perhaps a couple of centuries or so, and this resulted in certainly regional cooling, if not global cooling. Now, before then, the Younger Dryas lasted for longer, for 1,100 or 1,200 years. From 11,700 to 12,900, I think, and this was almost a global event, although it's not very manifest in Antarctic. And yes, there was a global cooling. The boundaries, the transition from earlier and also to later warmer periods was extremely abrupt, extremely sharp. It comes to show what happens when you get warming or cooling when the ice sheets can very rapidly melt or very rapidly freeze. Due to the albedo reversal effect.
On a side note, Andrew, I've seen various YouTubers and would-be scientists suggesting the Younger Dryas cooling was caused by an asteroid strike. I know you catalog those impacts from space objects. What do you think about that?
Yeah, I read the paper about it. No trace of evidence. It's an idea, but asteroids, certainly large asteroids, leave unmistakable traces, signatures, and a relatively recent asteroid event, which was enough to melt so much ice, would have had debris, ejecta, crater, all of that. I haven't seen any. All I've seen is what I would describe as circumstantial evidence, and circumstantial is, of course, very far from evidence.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
You are tuned to Radio EcoShock. Our guest is Dr. Andrew Glickson from Australia. We are talking about the unexpected future as climate change brings us some rude surprises. Andrew, I keep wondering, how is it possible that the great warming, which is now certainly developing, would not overwhelm any influence of glacial meltwater?
Yes, that's right. So the extent of the cooling of the oceans, which already has started now, as I mentioned before, the extent of it vis-a-vis the warming is not predicted or projected with any accuracy. I believe that Hansen is working on it from correspondence, but the precise modeling of the extent is not yet published as far as I'm aware. However, when you think about the Antarctic ice sheet, which contains the great bulk of ice on the Earth, and the potential for 60 or 70 meters sea level rise, When you think about it melting at a high rate, because warming now is the fastest warming since 56 million years ago. I've just looked at the evidence. It is absolutely the fastest. In fact, it's faster than 56 million years ago. And if Antarctica melts at such a high rate, and it is already has melted, the rate of melting of Antarctica has increased by sixfold since the 1970s. By sixfold, I even have the numbers in front of me, but I'm not sure that would like me to read them. Let me see. In Antarctica, in the 1970s, 79 to 1990, we look at 40 billion tons of ice melted per year. Between 2009 and 2017, it was six times as much. It was 252 billion tons per year. If it continues to melt at this rate, well, already we have a large fringe of cold water, which are lighter, by the way. The cold ice melt water are lighter than the ocean water otherwise, which are salty. So it floats on top, forms a layer on top. And that's already been documented, charted, and published, that there are large regions of low-density ice melt, cold ice melt, lying along the coast of Antarctica, mostly East Antarctic, and coming from the peninsula. So depends on the rate of melting, and Hansen in his 2016 paper already modeled it to some extent. So he has this several decades long study of cooling events. But that remains. I believe he's working on it, and depends on the rate of melting, rate of warming, rate of melting. It's likely to extend the cold water region around or south of Greenland and around Antarctic are likely to extend, since they have already extended. They started 10, 20 years ago, and they are now larger than they were. You can see it on the temperature maps. So this is a question, how far are they going to extend? And I don't have a crystal ball, but I feel that the process is developing.
We just had a report from NASA's Claire Parkinson about the record-smashing drop in sea ice around Antarctica from 2014 to 2017, and it was more jaw-dropping to me than what happened in 2007 in the Arctic. But does the amount of sea ice affect the stadial situation you and I have been talking about, or is that something completely different?
Well, one factor is the winds. The winds are intensifying around Antarctica. It's like a dancer who is folding her hands, and so she is rotating faster. The westerlies are intensifying, and this is one factor that would be breaking the ice. No, that's one factor.
So I want to get back to the Southern Ocean pretty quickly, because I think that those are major events that people tend to ignore because the bulk of people live in the Northern Hemisphere. But let's talk about something else that you wrote to me that's connected to all this, and that is what I would call the broken jet stream and winter storms. Now, we've had scientists on Radio EcoShock say that the loss of summer sea ice in the Arctic has weakened the jet stream in the Northern Hemisphere. Dr. Jennifer Francis of Rutgers published about it, and she explained it on the show. Others like Ken Caldeer and Patrick Brown are doubtful that the sea ice is the main driver. But let's get to the main point. Is there any doubt that the jet stream has changed in the last few decades?
Yes, it has been mapped by NASA from satellites and so on, and it has been more or less linear, continuous. Now it's undulating. Yes, and this is the other front. One front is in the oceans of global warming and the cooling and so on. The other front is in the atmosphere. And in the atmosphere, it's even clearer than in the oceans. What happens is the climate zones are shifting towards the poles, which means the tropical climate zone is expanding, and that's well charted on maps, and I think some of them are in papers I sent you. So the intermediate zones are shifting towards the poles. The best example, or clearest example, is the shift of the Sahara climate zones northward into North Africa and across the Mediterranean. That's where you get this tropical fronts reaching Europe, Southern Europe and so on, the heat waves, the fires, that's the expansion of the subtropical Sahara. Now, as it expands, warm fronts would penetrate, and they are penetrating and causing heat waves and fires in the Arctic Circle. On the other hand, as the Arctic itself warms, the difference in temperature between Arctic warming, which is on average 2.3 degrees or so, it's only the average, and between the warm fronts arriving from the south, the difference is decreasing. So the boundary defined by the jet stream is weakening and undulating. And this is very well documented. So as the tropics are expanding and the Arctic is melting and its boundary is weakening, we're having a fundamental, a major fundamental shift or migration of the climate zones on the Earth. And this is possibly the most striking shift in state of the terrestrial climate that we are looking at, quite apart from all the major extreme climate events.
Andrew Glickson, is it possible we could see some record cold and snow in North America, in Europe, and in Russia because of global warming?
Well, that's what we just had. When you had the beast from the east, so-called, which resulted in major freeze in North America and also major freezes in Europe, that's exactly what we're looking at. We're looking at penetration of climate zones, both north and south. This beast from the east, so-called, is a penetration from the Arctic, from the north, and the warming of, for example, Greenland, where much of the Greenland ice has become a slush, and much of it's melted on the surface. That's penetration of warm fronts from the south. We're looking at extreme disruption of the terrestrial climate pattern. It's almost unbelievable that this will happen so quickly and within our lifetime.
Yeah, I remember looking at weather maps last winter and thinking, you know, it's almost like the boundary between the Arctic and the temperate zones, as they used to be called, has been broken. And so that some of our heat goes up there, melts more ice. Some of the cold from the Arctic doesn't seem to have any wall of wind that used to keep it there and flows right down, particularly into eastern North America and into Europe. So you get incredible weather during times of global warming.
This is precisely right. You put your finger on it, Alex.
Before we leave this point, a lot of us are going to hate the new winter weather and wish global warming was nicer to us. It just seems like a perverse development.
You see, the Earth's climate has reached a balance, habitable balance, about 10, 11,000 years ago. Before then, the ice ages, the glacial, were not very comfortable, hospitable for humans, as you know, the struggle right through the ice ages. But this beneficial transition into a relatively stable climate stabilized approximately 7,000 years ago in the Great River Valleys when civilization developed. This is now coming to an end by an opposite trend. We're not descending into another ice age as such, but we are rising into a disrupted climate pattern. All of this, of course, is extremely complicated in a political sense because people like to think in, well, rather simplified ways, warming or cooling. And here we are moving into a chaotic, this would be the right term, chaotic climate. And what are we looking at? Exactly that. We're looking at a great increase in extreme weather events. But I'm certainly not talking about global cooling, even though people might interpret it as such. I'm not talking about global cooling. What I'm talking about is a shift into a chaotic climate regime.
And you mentioned something about stratification, and I've read in scientific papers and had some people on the program who really talk about this as a major worry, and yet the public is, I think, totally unaware of what ocean stratification is or why it matters. Can you talk to us a little bit about that?
Well, yes. I mean, I already talked about it in terms of what happens around the poles. and it's called low-density ice melt water, will form layers. It's layers are perhaps a few hundred meters, kilometers or so, over the denser salty water.
And but what does that do to the great conveyor belt, for example, that works in the ocean to distribute heat around the whole ocean?
Yes, well, the great conveyor belt, for example, in the North Atlantic thermal headline current, that's receding to the south. The conveyor belt is receding, partly because of the advance of cold water from Greenland. So it's slowing down. And as to stratification, in tropical zones and so on, the warm water, the warm seawater, heated by the greenhouse effect, is lighter than colder water deep inside. So some degree of stratification is developed, except it's disrupted by storms. So there are several processes going on, different in different parts of the globe.
Where would the blob of cold water in the southern hemisphere form, and would that affect the global ocean circulation system?
Yes, that's shown up in that temperature map of Antarctica and around it, which I've sent you. Most of the melting occurs in the Antarctic, West Antarctic and the Antarctic Peninsula, so the cold water are flowing onto. The map shows they are mostly flowing to the east of the offshore regions of East Antarctic. But this is spreading and it's contacting with the seasons and so on. That's where the ice melt water occurs. The degree to which it will further expand or contract in the future, again, any precise predictions are not possible. But as more ice melts, greater regions of ice melt water will form.
Could a cooling ocean around Antarctica affect the weather for our listeners in Australia and New Zealand?
To some extent, yes. To some extent, in Australia, same as in other regions, the continent itself will continue to warm from the greenhouse effect. But some of the margins might benefit from cold currents emanating from Antarctica, as we do. I mean, that Australia is partly inhabited and gets some cold fronts and rain is thanks to the branches of cold, wet, moist weather, the weather from Antarctic. That's so-called spider or spirals, which you can see on weather maps emanating from Antarctic and touching the southern part of Australia, Western Australia and parts of South and East Australia.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
You are tuned to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. My guest is Dr. Andrew Glickson from Australia, and we're talking about a jagged future, what I think Andrew just called climate chaos rather than climate change, where we could have heating. Yes, we'll have lots of heating, but there could also be regional cooling because of the effects of melting glaciers cooling the ocean waters, and we call that a stadial possible event. So, Andrew, it's my untrained understanding that the great glaciers help regulate the temperature on Earth and they moderate the rate at which we will experience warming. Is that true?
Well, they are the thermostats. The great glacier ice sheets are the thermostats of the Earth. Without them, we're going right back to the Cretaceous, which is older than 65 million years ago, when there was little or no ice on the poles, except episodically. So the global climate regime has changed fundamentally when, during the Eocene, which is from 55 million years ago to 32 million years ago, when large mountain ranges have emerged, the Himalaya, the Andes, and the Alps have emerged. And due to their emergence, a large amount of carbon dioxide was sequestered through weathering weathering of the rocks of the emerging mountain ranges. The sequestration of carbon dioxide by these mountains has resulted in major cooling of the Earth by more than 10 degrees. Depends on the region you're looking at. Remember, that's in deep time, and we're looking in the long term. The Earth's climate has fundamentally changed from tropical and subtropical to glacial during the since the formation of the Antarctic ice sheet about 32 million years ago. The Earth descended into a glacial state, but this included undulations, episodic changes between glacial and interglacial, especially since about 3 million years ago or so. So we are, in terms of a deep time evolution of the climate, we are in a deep glacial state, but this is a state which allows the development of the biosphere as we know it, and eventually of humans. We are rising, as we do, into tropical and semi-tropical, subtropical state, back again, up again, into Miocene and even Eocene conditions. Then this biosphere transforms, and when a biosphere transforms at such a rate as we're looking at now, the fastest rate we ever seen since 55 billion years ago, this can only result in mass extinction of species, because species can adapt. They can adapt particularly well, very well, during slow climate transition or moderate climate transition. But when the climate changes at the rate that it is now, between 2 and 3 parts per million carbon dioxide per year, and that's different.
So you told me that as long as the large ice sheets exist, we will experience, quote, tipping points, temporary reversals, and transient stadials. So why would the existence of big ice in places like Greenland and Antarctica lead us to temporary reversals? Is that the flow of ice into the ocean that you've been talking about? Is that what gives us a temporary reversal of change in a region?
That's exactly right. It's the melt of the ice sheets, which spread up cold water, spread up cold climate over the oceans, and this in turn also affects the continents or continental margins. But at the same time, the continents themselves, the cores of the continent, the centers, continue to heat. That's why I was referring to it as a transfer to chaotic climate. The boundaries between climate zones and between the tropics and the subtropics and between the intermediate zones and between the polar zones are weakening. So when the boundaries weaken, you get warm fronts and cold fronts clashing with each other.
Now, if we don't manage to drag carbon dioxide back out of the atmosphere and store it somewhere, and if we keep on burning fossil fuels for another decade or three, do you think it becomes inevitable that the ice on Greenland and Antarctica will melt away?
Not Antarctica will take a lot longer, but as to Greenland, the people who study Greenland and glaciologists, Greenland is an island, and at the rate that the melting there is increasing, and I have some figures here, there have been warm fronts which have reached Greenland, and I mentioned before, the ice became slush and get water at the surface, which results in albedo change and further melting. So Greenland, because glaciologists think Greenland is in danger. No one wants to give a date as to when it melts or melts, but it certainly has heat waves. It has large extents of ice melting. It has ice melt water, pools of ice melt water building up to the south. Antarctica is different. It's so huge. No one wants to talk about the total melting of Antarctica. I don't want to talk about it. But a large part of it, the melting has increased by sixfold since the last 30 or 40 years. So the ice sheets form the thermostats, but the existence of sharp boundaries between the poles and between the subarctic and intermediate zones, this has established the climate patterns that we live in. And you see, climate scientists don't have a crystal ball. We can't predict or project the future with any accuracy. But the trends are becoming clearer all the time, especially since the changes are so fast that it's happening against our eyes.
It is happening right in front of our eyes. And I wonder, though, would you say that the prospect of these cooling events, the stadial events, within the next few hundred years, is that a mainstream scientific idea at this time? Or are there a significant number of scientists who doubt this theory, who discount this as a serious problem?
Well, the mainstream is the IPCC, which is essentially correct. I would not say the IPCC is not correct. It's based on thousands of peer-reviewed papers. But as I said, no committee has ever written a symphony. You have to look at James Hansen and his very large group of climate, paleoclimate scientists. They are the exception. They have studied the climate for the last longer than 40 years. And largely, the observation has actually materialized. Unfortunately. So it's not picking up one group or the other. Scientists essentially are in agreement about what is happening. When it comes to projections, this is, of course, far more difficult. So you have to look at the evidence pretty closely in some detail to detect the trends and consider what is possible, what is not possible, what is inevitable. And to me, the melting of the ice sheets is happening now. The spreading of cold water pools is happening now. Of course, the question whether they will continue, what will be the balance between the overall greenhouse heating and between the overall ice melting? How will this balance control the extent of the ice melt water into the oceans? It has already extended largely, but this, of course, doesn't mean that it will continue to. These are the big questions, and I'm looking forward to when Hansen develops his projections further. I'm not doing modeling myself. Now, when it comes to carbon dioxide drawdown, how they're doing it, there are some potential techniques, but whether they would operate on the required scale, no one knows. What we do know is that the powers that be are pouring their trillions into preparation for the next war, that we know, and that this trillions is exactly what's required if we are to attempt to do anything to arrest the current disastrous development of the climate.
And you talked about the change in the North Atlantic Current, I think scientists call it AMOC, and it's already being measured. The public knows it mainly as the Gulf Stream, and I think a lot of people use the film The Day After Tomorrow as their model of what it happens. And we know that was simplistic, and they sped it up in time for Hollywood. But should people in the UK and Northern Europe brace themselves for a dose of the opposite of what they expected from global warming?
Well, yes, they should brace themselves for an increasingly chaotic state of the climate, which exactly, unfortunately, happening. Europe and the United States, in particular Europe, had major Arctic fronts penetrating it. We talked about it, the beast from the east, as well as major heat waves, tropical fronts, arriving across the Mediterranean from the Sahara. It's just been happening over the last several years. So this is no longer in the realm of projections. This is now, unfortunately, what is happening.
What do you expect will happen in your home of Australia as climate change reveals itself?
Well, where I'm living, the danger of an enormous drought, the biggest drought since what was called Federation drought at the beginning of the last century. This drought is so serious that there is now great concern for people on the land, what's going to happen to them and their cattle and sheep. Now, the other thing is fires. We are all over Australia, most of Australia, we are in severe, serious danger of fires. Summer is coming, and these fires can be so ferocious as they have been now in South Queensland, North and New South Wales, to some extent at the top end. They have already claimed tens of thousands of square kilometers, and many homes, and fortunately not many fatalities so far, because our fire protection services are very effective. So what's happening to Australia? Australia is the same as many other parts of the world. It's a forefront of climate change, possibly not as completely destructive as the islands, the Caribbean, the Southwest Pacific, the Philippines, and so on, subject to, increasingly subject to hurricanes and cyclones.
You know, I have to rethink how I'm doing this program because of this conversation we're having, because I really have been focusing on extreme heat and the developing heat waves, and I've been trying not to talk too much about the possibility we could see regional cold snaps because of climate change, because it sort of helps the climate deniers, and I'm still trying to struggle how we're going to overcome that hurdle and say, yes, it's going to be jagged. We could go down for a bit. We could go down for a bit for, it looks like, 10, 20 years in a stadial and then come back. And that's very difficult to get across to people that we have to cut our greenhouse gases.
You're precisely right. The deniers, for their own reasons, ideology and politics, they can distort the science, they can distort the truth. And they have been doing it now for several decades with enormous damage to science, enormous risk to nature and civilization. I don't believe that true scientists can do anything except for looking at the evidence and trying to develop the best projections they possibly can on the basis of facts and evidence. I don't know how scientists can do that. I wish, of course, that the projections were a bit more simple and understandable, easy to follow to the public. But to somehow change peer review papers accordingly is actually doing in principle what the denialists are doing. Let's do that. Now, unfortunately, for one thing, I'm not talking about global cooling. It's a misnomer. It's a move into a climate chaos. That's what I see it in, and that's how I can only define it in terms of the best projections which I can look at. So anyone who will say that climate scientists are talking about global cooling is once again lying. And some of these people are very good in lying. They are backed by millions of dollars and institutions. Sooner or later, I'm going to find my name in the tabloids saying Andrew Glickson is projecting global cooling, which is it's a pure lie. When you talk about cooling of parts of the oceans, you're not talking about global cooling.
So this whole topic that we're covering, you did publish a paper this August about it. Could you tell us where it's published and the title of your paper?
The paper which you're referring to is in the Journal of Climatology. It's been published last year or earlier this year. The paper is called North Atlantic and Sub-Antarctic Ocean Temperature, Possible Onset of a Transient Stadial Cooling Stage.
That transient cooling, though, I know we're saying this over and over again, but I have to make this clear to our listeners. We're talking about something that might happen that would affect the U.S. East, perhaps, the Canadian East, and Europe, and, you know, but around the North Atlantic, we may have a regional cooling, and somewhere around Antarctica, we may have a regional cooling, but we may see India hot, too hot almost to live in, and we may see the Middle East getting even hot. I mean, the heat will continue, but we'll have regional cooling, and it could be jagged.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. The continents, and you're talking here about Africa and talking here about India, regions close to in the tropics, continental regions in the tropics, they continue to warm due to the greenhouse effect. Whether this warming will be somewhat mellowed or weakened due to the regions of the ocean which are cooling, it's not known, but it can be subject to more detailed modeling and so on. I think to really want to look at what Hansen and his group are doing, I am looking from point of view of paleoclimate mostly, and this idea is looking at the studies which have happened in the past, the Laurentian, the Younger Dryas, and previous studial events. There have always been studies during the interglacial periods. Every study, every interglacial period in the past 400,000 years had a stadial associated with following the peak temperatures. So I started looking at it from that point of view. But the people who would model the future projection, climate projections, that's not me. Hansen is doing it, but they have not published the modeling yet, I know that, except there is already a lot in their comprehensive 2016 paper.
You are tuned to Radio EcoShock, your climate emergency broadcast. I'm Alex Smith, your host. Our guest is the distinguished Australian scientist Dr. Andrew Glickson, originally from Australian National University. Andrew publishes his work in scientific journals, but lately also in the alternative press. Apparently, coal-friendly media in Australia are not interested in hearing the dire news, even though they are living right through it now. Let's get back to how areas of cold water forming in the oceans due to waters pouring in from melting glaciers can throw our climate and weather into more chaos. You know, we would almost want to compare an ocean cooling like that to La Niña, where the cooler waters bubble up out of the eastern Pacific, and that changes climate pretty well around the northern hemisphere. So maybe some cooling from these waters coming off the glaciers could be a good thing in a sense that it gives us a little more time for our action on climate change and slows down the process. What do you think about that?
Well, the ENSO cycle, La Niña, El Niño, are different. They occur, the core of it is in the tropics, on the equator close to it, whereas when you're talking about the stadial or ice melt flow from the poles, we're talking about cooling which starts, emanates, is focused around the poles and away from the poles. With the La Niña, El Niño, you're looking at equatorial processes. So it's not quite the same. But whether we will have more time, well, I pray they have more time. But looking at what's happening, global emissions are only rising. The resources, those resources which we still have, are going into the preparation of wars, I'm afraid possibly nuclear wars. As you can see, I'm not exactly optimistic. I wish I was. I wish I could see reason for optimism. But when it comes to human behavior, I don't know. I understand you are more optimistic than I am, and I wish I had your state of mind.
Well, my opinion is it is too late to stop a big climate shift over this century and in the centuries to come, but maybe we can prevent a real hell on Earth, what David Wallace Wells called uninhabitable Earth. What do you think, Andrew Glickson? Is it too late for human action to prevent serious climate disruption?
Well, the best spokesperson for this hope is this little girl, 16 years old, Greta Thunberg. I admire what she is doing, trying to do. She went to the United Nations. She went across the Atlantic in a sailboat. She went to other places. And what she says is precisely correct. Every word she says, and she mainly says, just listen to the science, listen to the scientists. She had a major effect. And if it does not have an effect on our beloved leaders, who have left the Paris Agreement, not the Paris Agreement was had any commitments attached to it. Major powers in the world, the US, Russia, China, Australia included, don't seem to really listen to the science very much, do they?
No, they're building the fossil fuel future. I mean, Australia wants to expand coal exports, already the greatest coal exporter in the world, want to make it even more so. America wants to become the energy superpower and produce more fossil fuels than the Middle East. And Russia, of course, is just pumping it out and raking the billions going into who knows whose pockets. So it looks like we are building a fossil fuel future, which means we're not building a future at all. We're getting ready to wreck the future. But I do have some hopes that humans can kind of move in a wave and in a fairly short time possibly turn things around. I haven't given up that hope, but I got to admit right now it looks pretty dark.
Well, Alex, I would hate to think that I'm one person, one sector, which redeems your hope. I truly hope that your hope is justified. I truly hope that it will eventuate. I don't know. I have to detach my emotions, my feelings from scientific observations. I just have to do it, and most scientists have to do it. If we enter our emotions into it, then in principle we can become very much like the denialists. They insert their ideology, their politics, their money, all of their human, very human type of foibles into the science, and that's why, well, I see them as criminals in terms of the consequence of their lies. Now, as to climate scientists in general, of course, we each have our individual optimism or pessimism. But I think most scientists try and detach this feeling, emotion, human emotion and feelings from the science itself. You have to be as objective as you possibly can. That's what medical doctors have to do all the time. When they stand in front of the bed of a patient, if the patient is beyond recovery, sooner or later, they have to let the family know, despite and against their own feelings. Climate scientists are in a very similar situation, except not everybody has the temerity to say it in public.
It's so strange to be alive when being alive is partly a guilty pleasure, and it's so precarious, it's so weird to finally begin to know how the universe and the Earth works just in time to see that we are wrecking the foundations of life. And so that's the strange situation that I'm in with every show.
Yes, indeed. I understand and I empathize very much. And it's nice to talk with you because conversation with you make a lot of sense in both the scientific and also the human aspect.
Well, we're going to have to leave it there, Andrew. We've spent a wonderful hour together, and from Australia, we have been talking with Dr. Andrew Glickson, and you will find links to the science we've talked about, all the papers and more, in my weekly show blog published Wednesdays at ecoshock.org, and you can download this interview for free there, too. Andrew, thank you so much for gracing our airwaves.
Yeah, well, thank you, Alex. I hope that the term global cooling does not come into any communication, whether in the media or radio or anywhere, because this is not what I'm saying.
Right. It's a possible temporary regional cooling due to what we're doing. But yeah, I think our listeners will get that. We've got a bunch of really intelligent listeners here on Radio EcoShock, so I think we'll get that message out properly. I'm Alex Smith, and I'm reporting for Radio EcoShock, and I thank you for listening to this show. I think this interview can help us all understand the weather chaos we witness every night on TV news, and unfortunately, at times raging around our own homes. For example, I have been stunned at the almost continuous storm track at the end of summer 2019, where everything from tornadoes to sweeping rains and floods with high winds have formed in the central plains and washed over the American and Canadian East Coast. It seemed like it was happening every second night. Now we know the big continent is heating up, but further north in the Atlantic, the ocean is cooling. Storms form in the little space between those hotter and colder areas. Recall, too, how bitterly disappointed climate-aware people were when the 2009 climate conference, the COP, happened during an extreme cold snap in Copenhagen. That may have made it harder to mount public pressure and more difficult for politicians to realize our danger. But now we learn that cold wave was also part of global warming. That makes it clearer, and we did not realize this until recently, until James Hansen raised the whole meltwater cooling in his 2016 paper, and until the new work came out about the weakening of the jet stream. It is just to further irony this retrograde development of cooler oceans is happening in the basin where the largest English-language media pumps out news around the world from New York and from London. Now you will know where those unexpected cold waves will come from. Perhaps knowledge of this development in New Science will help immunize you and your friends from the certain abuse by the climate denial industry. When a Senator Jim Inhofe throws a snowball to disprove warming, or President Trump tweets something along the lines of, "Well, where is that global warming?" during some icy New England storm, you know why that is so wrong. Of course, those deniers hope we already forget the record heat waves we just experienced last summer. Those don't count. It's the old saying, who are you going to believe, me or your lying eyes? I was serious in saying it is possible superstorms may write history. We have just seen a tremendously damaging storm hit Japan in October 2019, Typhoon Hagibis. And yes, even the Japanese who try to engineer their way out of climate change admit that all the billions spent on defenses cannot protect against such powerful storms. I intend to do more programs on the coming megastorms to complement the book Storms of My Grandchildren by Dr. James Hansen. Finally, I would like to compliment you, as a listener, for hanging in there. We get scientists from all over the world, with all kinds of accents, talking about really complicated stuff. But can there be any more important real-life news? Forget all the fluff, the politics, the cat videos. We are talking now about the great crisis facing humanity and all the life forms we share. This is big news from the climate emergency. I'm Alex Smith. Really, thank you for listening and caring about our world. Nobody wants to hear this. Your friends and family and workmates don't. But honestly, when we add up the science and our own experiences in the real world, when we look at the unstable weather in the news, there is no choice but to speak up. Forget that envy of a better car or truck or house. Forget chasing paper wealth. Look at the young innocents around us and the other unknowing species, the other passengers on this planet. Even in small steps, whatever changes we can make in our own lives matters most. Whatever sign we can make, whatever we can do, matters now. Become a climate activist. Gama ba 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 ba